History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. They really don't have to go untold because we still have a chance to do something about it. Take some initiative, ask some questions, invest a little time to listen, and you may make a bigger difference than you really realize. Our goal here has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. That label, The Greatest Generation, was made famous, of course, by Tom Brokaw decades ago. He was describing the 16 million Americans who served in World War II, not to mention the millions more on the home front who supported that war effort. But today, we get to hear from a member of that generation who was fighting in the skies over Europe for America's ally, Great Britain. Ron Holdsworth will be taking to the skies again this week as part of a special program we'll tell you about later. And if you live close enough, you might even be able to welcome him home. He lives in Bakersfield, California now, but 80 years ago, when 103-year-old Ron Holdsworth was just in his 20s, he survived 32 missions as a tail gunner in Halifax bombers. So 103 years old, that means we're going quite a ways back. What do you remember about your childhood in jolly old England?
Yeah, well, there was my mother and father, and I had six sisters and a brother that ranged from the difference in the ages. The oldest one, Stan, was born in 1915, and the youngest girl was born in 1927. There was eight children. My brother was the oldest, and I was fourth position.
And I've talked to a lot of Americans about your age, and they went through that Great Depression here in the States, and having a lot of mouths to feed was a big challenge.
Oh, yeah, well, it was with us, you know, and eight children, and my father worked on the public transport. Eight children is a lot to feed, and he was a very friendly guy with the people on the buses and streetcars and whatever. He used to get to know people that were in a position to help and whatever and give you stuff and whatnot, you know. And I know as we got older, we all had to take our turn. And here, go to this place, I tell you, my dad said, give you different things. It was either food or clothing or stuff like that. And I know one streetcar route that he went on, there was a butcher shop, and every Saturday night when the shop's getting ready to close, some of the stuff they'd have to dump or whatever. So the guy that owned the shop, I guess, made arrangements with my dad, because he used to go and take the guy change. You know, when he's in the shops, you could have change when people buy stuff and you get the paper money back. One of us had to go up on the streetcar and get off and go to the shop, go in the shop, they knew who we were. And they had this big carrier bag full of stuff, and then we used to go back and take it home, you know. And it was sausages and some kind of meat and all that kind of stuff. But with my dad knowing the guy and being friends, he got a real good deal at the end of the day on a Saturday, you know. Well, eight kids, you know, one of us had to go up and get it and bring it back home on the streetcar. Mm-hmm. We didn't pay on the streetcar, you know, because they let us ride.
And I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember as a boy there in England having an idea, a dream, hey, when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life, or this is who I want to be?
I didn't know what I wanted to be, because when I was a youngster, I don't know how old I was at the time, something happened to my right leg, and it kind of pulled up, they had me in bed at home for quite some time. And then they said they'd have to take me to the hospital, so they took me to the hospital. And I can't remember exactly. I think I was in there about 3 months.
Wow.
So it made an awful lot of difference to my schooling and I missed a lot of things. But they had my leg up like this and like a pin on it and on a pulley, and every so often they'd put things that weights on to. They kind of put down and it was in the joint here or something. And anyway, eventually, they had this big sticking plaster all over my leg.
Wow.
Well, one day the nurse came up to me and she said, Ron, we're going to give you a bath. I said, oh, that sounds good. She said, but before we give you the bath, we're going to take all that plaster off your leg. Well, imagine it's pulling that plaster off the leg.
A little painful?
Oh, man. And then they took me to the, and gave me a bath. That was felt good, you know. And then I forget what they did then or something, but they started walking around the ward a bit and then a bit more, and then it got that I could kind of walk fairly good. And so the day came when they let me go. My dad was working. My mother couldn't come because she had the little one. So my older brother, he and his friend came and picked me up from the hospital and carried me on their shoulders, to go to the bus stop. Then we got on the bus, and the bus passed the end of our street and stopped, and I just had to carry me up the street to back home and that. And then after time, it was fine.
Well, I was going to say, they must have done a good job because you're still walking at 103. There's not too many people who can say that.
They're a fashion, yeah.
I was thinking, with the American vets, they all have a clear memory of when America got pulled into the war after Pearl Harbor. But for someone who grew up in England, what was the moment when you knew you were at war?
Let's see, the war broke out in 1939, mm-hmm. in September 1939, what caused the Second World War? The German troops dressed up in Polish uniforms and attacked Poland and said it was their fault, and that gave them an excuse to start. Anyway, the war started in September, and I was 18 in September. Germany did the bit on the 1st of September, and France and Germany declared war on the 3rd of September, and then on the 13th of September, I was 18, and I was working for a paper and twine merchant. I ran the warehouse. Anyway, yeah, the war broke out, and I thought to myself, on my birthday, I said, now I'm 18, I guess I'll be going into service, when they call me up, because 18 is about when they start to grab you. I was thinking of going to volunteer for the Navy, but then someone told me, you can't sign up for just certain years, you have to sign up for a certain period of time. Well, that's a long time, and what happens if I don't like it, So I didn't do that, naturally. So I waited a little bit longer, and then I went and volunteered for the Air Force, where I did all the paperwork and then the physical and etc. And then you go back home and wait until you're called. But I did this on my own. I didn't tell my mother and father. My mother had a fit. I told her everything. And I'd volunteered, So anyway, the time came and the paper came and told us to report to the office, and they took us and put us on the train, and we got to the camp where we were supposed to report. We were only there a day because they were so crowded, they couldn't cope with everybody. So we were there just long enough to get our number. They sent us back home. That was in February. I think it was April. when we got recalled. And then we were in the Air Force then. We were there just line up, give us a meal, and they marched us out of the camp and up the road a piece and then a bit more to the local railroad station. We got on the train, and we didn't go travel too far. And when we got out, we found we were at a place called Blackpool. It's a holiday town. That's where we ended up. And they got us all lined up and marched us from where the train station was to the promenade, partway down the promenade, and then started drifting off on these streets and avenues. And they'd stop every so often at a boarding house or a private hotel, and they read so-and-so's name. And this is where you're going to be staying for 6 weeks. Three of us were detailed to this boarding house. It was very nice. We got the same food as the people that pay to stay there for their week's holiday or whatever. It would have been better than the food in the camp anyway. So we were there for 6 weeks. Every morning about 8 o'clock, I think it was, we'd have to be outside in the street and other guys coming out the other places, you know, until we were all outside. And they'd march you off to do whatever they were going to do that day. If it was jumping up and down or running or marching, we did a lot of drilling and all that kind of stuff. And one day they took us to get your shots at this converted Sunday school building. The forms were in a row and you walked down the middle, and they had medics or doctors on each side to give you the shots, you know. They say, what's your name? Anywhere between 2 and 3 shots they got. And out of the building, onto the road, fall in, all get rid of. The guy that was next to me, he said, hey, son, what's your mate? He's swaying. That was me. And he goes, those shots have been a shock to me, you know. Anyway, we finished our training at that place. We were told to get our gear all packed and the next morning be outside at such and such a time with your gear. They would call out so many names. You guys are going to so-and-so place. And I think there was 8 of us. We were sent to a place called Dishforth. That's a bomber station. It was a bomber station then, with the early bombers of Whitley, the Whitley bomber. So we were sent there to do this and that and anything they could find you to do. Swamp the floors or whatever, you know, be on guard duty. And I said, I don't fancy this, you know. So they said I couldn't get into aircrew. So I signed up to go on a mechanics course. They sent me off and I graduated from the flight school. I think around about Christmas time. And I was back at home. And I got this notification to report to RAF station just outside London. So I had to travel back from York down to London. Didn't know where the hell I was, you know. And this young gal and lady came up to me and said, are you lost? And I said, well, kind of. I told them where I had to get to. She says, oh, we'll see that you get there. So they took me down in the underground and got on the train to the place where I had to get off. And they told me what to do when I got out of the train. Right across the street, there's a bus stop. You go there and then you get on that bus. They'll tell you where you're going to go. So I said thank you very much to them. And that's what I did. And the bus conductor stopped the bus practically outside the gates because I had my kit bag with me and all that kind of thing, so I wouldn't have to walk so far. And from there, I was at this RAF station. That's when they told me they didn't have sleeping quarters there. Everybody was billeted out. So they took me to a place not too far from the camp so that I could walk and talk to the people there. It was just a young couple with a little tot. Said they will billet me onto them. They said, okay, they'll show me the room. where I was going to stay, and they had this little tot, you know. It followed me all over the place. Anyway, I had to get up in the morning, and I could go to the mess hall. They had a mess hall when I got there. But these couple of hours insisted I have something to eat that before I leave. They were so nice. Anyway, I left there and went to where I was supposed to be, and it was hurricanes. We worked on hurricanes, you know. Heck, I wasn't there 2 minutes. I was only there about a couple of months or something like that. I got no idea, not long, because I was sent back home. But I wasn't at home all that long. Then I had to report to another transit camp, and we were there for a couple of weeks. They told us to get gear. Next thing we knew, we were going up the gangplank. We left Liverpool sometime in April, and we went out into the Atlantic and joined the convoy and sailed south. There's all kind of rumours going on where we were going and where you can't. Say, well, you've got your tropical outfit, says, oh, you're going where it's warm, you know. But anyway, we were in cabins on this particular ship, you know, which is unusual. During the night, there was such a bump. And of course, the story and the tales were, oh, we're being torpedoed. You know, And then the siren went off and told a report to the boat stations and all that. And after we stood at the boat station for a while, we were told to return to our cabins. It turned out that it wasn't torpedoed. You know, it's a lot of. Our ship and another ship collided. We don't know what caused it or anything, but I don't know whether you know or not, but ships at sea at dark, when they, especially in convoys, if they're going to turn or whatever, there's it's each for one way and the port, but for the other way. Anyway, they fixed us up in West Africa there. Off we sailed down and round the Cape. I think one or two ships left us for Cape Town. I don't know whether most of them went, but we ended up at Durban, which is round the corner from Cape Town.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 103-year-old Ron Holdsworth of Bakersfield, California. We'll hear his closest call aboard a Halifax bomber, and we'll tell you what special opportunity he's enjoying this week and when you can welcome him home. Head over to the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Ron, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 103-year-old Ron Holdsworth of Bakersfield, California. He was in the Royal Air Force in World War II, with his time in uniform lasting longer than the entire time America was involved in the war. When we left off, young Ron had trained to be a mechanic on British warplanes. Eventually, he'd fly in them. But let's pick things up in Durban, South Africa.
When we got off the ship, they put us on a train, and it was only just outside the town of Durban. And we were there for 2 weeks. It was nice there, a nice time. We could go into Durban, and of course we didn't have a lot of money in those days, you know. And it's, And any times he didn't get paid, we met some nice frat people, you know, some nice girls who were dancing and whatever. Then the time for us came for us to go. They took us to the docks again. And when we saw the ship we were going on, I thought, oh, my God. It wasn't at all like the other one. And most of us slept on the deck all the way up the side of East Africa, you know. We ended up through the canal, I forget the name, that Ismailia, I think it was. I know we were there for close to 3 months, just doing nothing, just sleeping in tents, and we didn't do anything. And then they came and told us we were moving, so we put us on another crappy old ship and took us down to Mombasa. We got off the boat and we boarded the train about, I'm quite sure, it was late at night, and the train had wood seats, and we travelled about 100 miles from there to Nairobi, and then we travelled another 100 miles to Nakuru, and Nakuru was about 600 and some feet higher up than the lowlands, and it was a little more tolerable, a bit more cooler, you know. Well, anyway, that was a training station for Blenheims, you know, three-member crew. And we were the mechanics of various trades, worked on them, doing this and that and the other. I was a flight mechanic, airframe. I was there for... We arrived there in September. The following May, I and some of the guys, we were transferred to the maintenance unit in Nairobi, about 6 months. And then one day, the engineering officer came over and said, "Pack your gear." And I said, "Where am I going now?" He said, "You're going to Madagascar." Oh boy. So I was going by myself on the train back to Mombasa in a crappy old boat. Well, it went to two or three places before it came back to Madagascar, you know, and dropped off there just before Christmas. So I spent Christmas on Madagascar. We were on the peninsula and the mainland across the bay. I think there was 24 of us on the peninsula, and we had two Lysanders. I seemed to be the only guy that was doing anything, you know. They moved us eventually onto the mainland. And one morning, the clerk came to me and he said, "Ron, pack your gear." I said, "What for?" I said, she said, "You're going back to Nairobi." I said, "What's the reason?" He says, "Your aircrew train's come through." So they flew me back on a Sunderland flying boat. Before I went, the guy said, "But you can't take your stuff with you because of the weight on the, you know, you're only allowed so much." And that. He said, "All you can take is a change of underwear, your toiletries, and that's it. We'll forward the other stuff on to you." Well, you know, I never saw it again. I had all kinds of stuff that I collected. Never saw it again, because I guess each place I went to from there, somebody'd have a little double out of it. But anyway, I was in Nairobi for a couple of weeks, I think it was, somewhere around there. And they gave me a few tests, and then they said, "Get your gear together." And I think there was three of us. We were back up to Nakuru again. And then past Nakuru, they put us on the lake steamer, and we went down to the south of the lake. Put us on a train. But we finally ended up in Tanganyika. We were just right about on the border of the Belgian Congo. And we got on some boats and we travelled partly through a jungle in a truck. All I forgot to tell you, with us were three South African officers and three South African WAF girls, you know. And they were travelling with us, you know, on the trains and everything else. And they were on the trucks with us when we went through the jungle and all that. There was like missionaries there, and they had a nice building and that. And we took us all in there. We all had showers and they fed us. And the time came for us to go, and we went on another train and finally ended up in Bulawayo. Anyway, after it all settled down, they took us to this RAF camp. and it was mostly training. We did a lot, but some math too, quite a bit of math. Mostly we did the Morse, we learned the Morse code and some of the bits and pieces. And then they moved us from, it was called Hillside. They moved us from there to the place where we did a lot of training. It was called Guello. And we did this and that, and, you know, one little bit of this. And then we started flying with the navigators, you know, companions and whatever, you know. Anyway, when all that was done and we had done all our gunnery stuff and aircraft recognition, when we've done all that and all was finished, then we got our stripes. Because, I guess, because we'd been over, well, most of us had been abroad about 3 years then, they were sending us back to England. We had to go from Rhodesia back to South Africa, where we started from, Durban, and wait for a ship to take us home. They took us up as far as Egypt, because then the crew got mad, because they thought they were going to go back to England, you know. But for some, well, I don't know what happened, but they had to go back somewhere else and left us in Egypt. We had to catch an army troop ship coming from the Far East, which comes through the canal and that. They put us on that one, and that was all army people. And we got this business all the time. You know. Finally, when we got back to Liverpool, it was in the wee hours of the morning because it was dark. We were told, you know, we get off the ship. As we were walking down the gangplank to the dock, on the next deck above was a bunch of army guys going, drinking boys. And we were going, you know.
You were returning the salute with a finger, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So because you're getting off the boat first. We got with it. They put us on a train, and we ended up at Harrogate, and we're there for, I guess, till they sorted things out. And then from Harrogate, we were sent to a place called Catterick. And we was in this big building, and it was just full of aircrew. Pilots, navigators, bombardiers, radio guys, and gunners. And then we were told, sort your own crews out. Get to know each other and have you make your own crews. So that's what we did. And there were six of us. We were sent up to Lossiemouth in North Scotland. And that's where we trained together on Wellingtons. That was a twin-engine bomber. We did all our training on that, and then you all did your individual training about other things and, you know, gunnery and all. Then the time came for us to... We were going back to Yorkshire to the last part of our training. And then we joined the rest of the guys for training on the Halifax bomber. And that's where we picked up the flight engineer. Then we finished there and we were sent to Lisset in East Yorkshire to the squadron, 158 squadron. And when we got there, the rest of us found out that we didn't have a flight engineer. And it was known then that the pilot wouldn't accept the flight engineer. He said he didn't think he was trained enough. We still went onto the squadron without a flight engineer. So when we started operations, we got a spare flight engineer that was on the squadron, because there were spares of all trades over one thing and another. So that's when we started operations. Our first operation was to Brest. Our second was to La Pochenelle, which was a flying bomb site. Our third was to Calais, and then the next three was to Le Havre. 3 days in a row to Le Havre. That was all done, and then there were the German targets from then on in. All the different targets we went to, and sometimes you were, you know, other times it wasn't bad. There was one place I thought was kind of hairy. We went 3 days in a row. That really made you twitter, you know. Yeah. A bit, because at that time we didn't have our own aircraft. We keep getting a spare aircraft. A crew's having a day off or they're on vacation. You'll be flying in their aircraft until the time came when you got your own. And on this particular time, we were flying different planes, you know. Well, same kind of plane, but we have been flying in, I don't know whether it was Wyork or something, one of them anyway. And we were doing the bombing run at Gelsenkirchen again, and that was a hot spot, you know, really hot. The flak was coming up, and the plane that we had been in the day before, on the same place, phew, it was away in front of us, you know, on the run end. It got a belly hit or something, you know, and it just, and I think, oh, thank the Lord we weren't in that one, you know.
So the very plane that you had flown the previous mission in went down and those guys were lost.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, that certainly underscores the possibilities of what could happen to you. Maybe you can tell us in general what it's like to be in the tail gun of a Halifax on a bombing mission. What are you watching for? What are you seeing? What are you feeling? What's well, that duty like?
It's at nighttime, you can't see anything, you know, because if there is something, it'll be all of a sudden, you know. Yeah. And to me, they're not going to do that because they're going to hit you or something. And if they hit you, they'd hit too, you know. In my position, for us, all our missions, we completed all right without any things. We might have had an odd dint once, a couple of times, but something you don't really notice. But I never had to bear my guns on anything all the time that I flew.
And that's 32 missions.
But I was there all the time, you know, nothing to look at. Well, I'd seen them. I did see a lot of fighters at night time because that's mostly when we went.
Because the Americans would fly during the day and then you would hit some of those same targets at night?
Yeah. We did some day trips as well, you know, but most of them were at night. I can say I never even saw a fighter. I saw the flak.
Well, that's got to be unnerving too, because isn't that a little helpless when you see the flak coming up?
Oh, well, you can't do anything about it. No. I've seen other planes go down. You know, because it was a long run, and especially in the rear turret. You're on your own. There's nobody there. Up front, there's the pilot, the navigator, the bombardier, or bombimmer, as we call them, and the flight engineer. There's four of them up front. They can see each other all the time. You know? And then behind them, sitting on as a radio operator. So that's five of them, because the middle of the gunners, and he can see them. And the rear gunner's on his own, he's on his toddy. He can't see anybody. It's, I wouldn't say it was nerve-wracking, it's just irksome at times, you know. What are you going to do, you know? Yeah. You sit there all the time. Fortunately, I never had to use my guns on an operation.
But the enemy was using guns against you, and there's proof of that on your wall. It's a picture I first saw in our friend Arnold Martinez's book, Never Forget. He put that in there, too. That's from Christmas Eve, 1944. What happened that day?
Oh, we were scheduled for a flight to a German airfield. It was in the industrial rural area, you know, something like that. They had this fighter airfield, which was a very, very annoying, you know. And so they sent us, it was Christmas Eve day, yeah. We just ran along in daylight, and we were, you have three leaders. You have the point and the starboard and the port, you know, three of you. And we were starboard leader, and just before we got up to the target is when we got hit, and it shook the aircraft, and I thought, what the hell's happened now, you know, because me being at back, you can't see anything or anything, you know. And then, of course, the plane wobbled and that, and then I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be a guest of adults for Christmas.
If you look at the photo of Ron Holdsworth's plane at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you will marvel at how he didn't end up in captivity, or worse. The rest of this 103-year-old's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club.
Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest is 103-year-old Ron Holdsworth of Bakersfield, California, a Royal Air Force veteran who survived 32 missions as a tail gunner in Halifax bombers during World War II. When we left off, he was describing Christmas Eve, 1944, when his plane was struck by an enemy round, and as we heard Ron say, he thought he was going to be a guest of Adolf, as in Hitler, for Christmas.
But anyway, I thought, well, I better keep put until the skipper says, calls and says anything, you know. But he wasn't saying anything right then. We still kept flying, it was going on. So I thought, being at the back and not seeing anything, you know, it's awkward. Everybody else in the plane can see or hear what's going on. But you can't until whatever happens, if you get out of it and all that, they can come and tell you. After a little period of time, I think it was the skipper that called me on the intercom and told me what had happened. But he said, we're all right, we're flying all right. We're still going to the target. So we went on and bombed him and did his thing. We were all right coming back, but we didn't land on our station, a place called Carnaby. It was an emergency landing strip on the coast. We landed on that.
Because of the damage, and I think I read that, didn't you guys have to lower your altitude so you could breathe?
Yeah, well, that was the skipper's job, you know, whatever that goes on up front. Me being at the back, I don't know what the hell's going on. So that's what happened. We landed at Carnaby because he wanted to make sure that it was okay. So they landed all right, and then it was dark, so we couldn't see exactly what had happened. I think some transport came from our station, because it's not that far from our squadron. And so we went back, and everybody thought we were heroes, you know, good show and all that kind of stuff. When he got back, we had to go through inspection and all that first, you know. Well, you have to give your report, whatever they're doing, whatever the radio or the pilot or whatever, you have to give a report. And you'll get your toddy, a shot of whiskey or rum or something, you know. But then you can go to the dining room and scoff up and whatever. Then you go and have your beers and whatever, and if you have a WAF friend on the station, she'd be there as well, you know. Thank the Lord, you know, and all that kind of thing. Go back and get sleep. And then the next day, the skipper got I think it was four standing, plus the guy, I think it was a navigator taking the picture. Uh-huh. Yeah, and he took that picture that's there.
And that picture shows a big gaping hole in the side of the fuselage, and what's your understanding of what caused all that damage?
What we were told is we were hit by, they don't know for sure whether it was an exploding shell that went through or a piece of flak that went through. But whatever it was, it shows you where it came in. And then it went through and out the other side. Now, whether it was on a shell that didn't explode or a piece of shrapnel, we don't know. But the damage was done by the oxygen bottles, because whatever it was hit the oxygen bottles and phew, they blew. And the oxygen bottles did the damage, because it blue from the inside, and practically all the perspex in the nose was blown out. And of course the bombing was still there, and the navigator not far from him. But the bombing, he got frostbite on one of his fingers with, because it's pretty cold at 18,000 feet, you know.
Well, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I want to hear it from you. Whether it was an unexploded shell or shrapnel or whatever, but I think you do know that you weren't too far from not coming home from that mission. A few inches here or there?
I think it was a piece of shrapnel. I think if it had been a shell, it would have probably done more damage.
But if it were placed a little differently, it could have ended things for all of you.
Yeah. Like I say, the damage was done with the oxygen bottles blowing up, yeah, and blowing it from the inside.
Did your heart beat a little faster after that one?
Oh, at the time, you know, you think you're going to do, but you don't. It's amazing. You know, I seemed more not content, you know, but I wasn't shaking like a leaf or something like that, you know, because the plane was still flying. That was the main thing. The plane was still flying, and it didn't drop or anything like that. And when the skipper said, we're going on to the target, then I knew that whatever had happened, the plane was still flyable.
Were you guys all decorated for that mission?
Well, I wasn't, naturally, you know. Or the mid-upper gunner, or the radio guy, the pilot, the navigator, the bombardier. I think those three got the Distinguished Flying Medal.
Well, speaking of medals, I saw a few of them on your wall up there. Is there anything that, when you look at it, it gives you particular pride or satisfaction?
Of course, I got a commission, and the bomber got a commission. The pilot and the navigator were already commissioned, so that four of us were commissioned. When I finished the last mission, I was commissioned. I don't know what happened on the last mission, because it turned out that I never got to see the pilot or any of the crew or anything like that. They just whisk you off, and they said, go get some rest, and, you know, and then the next day when I got up, pack all your gear, you're going home. And they just whisked me off and put me on the train and off. So I never got to, that time, I never got to find out about the pilot or the rest of the crew or any of them. I didn't know where they were or whatever, you know. So, but later I found out that the pilot and I were the only two out of the original crew that flew on the last mission. All the others were spares.
And that was 80 years ago, and you've never seen any of those other crew members again?
Never saw any one of them. Oh, the mid-upper gunner I saw. I went over on a visit. I went to see my brother. He let me use his car to drive up the coast, because I learned that the mid-upper gunner was still alive up there. Uh-huh. So I found out where he lived and went up there, but I was shocked when I saw him. He had those, those metal things on your arms where you have to walk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and braces on his legs. Mm. Oh, I was in a mess and could hardly see. His wife had passed away. And not long after I got back here, I got a letter from his son to say that his dad had died.
So you saw him just in time?
I saw him just in time, yeah. And I tried to get some information out of him, and he didn't know, because he had, during our tour of operations, I know he had missed a flight. Everybody said, something to do with his wife and had a baby, you know, real early. And he didn't know about the last trip either, what happened or where he was. He couldn't even think where he was. I said, well, that's a fine, how do you do, you know? And I said, I know on the last trip, I didn't know, because as soon as we got off the plane, normally they let us just wander and do what we do and take our stuff off and take your parachute back and all that kind of thing. They just rushed us around and, you know, And then we got something to eat, and that's when I found out that these guys in their clothing and that, they weren't the regular crew. I had flown with the five other guys I didn't even know.
You were back there by yourself. You had no idea.
I didn't know a damn thing, no. and when we got off on the last trip, you know, our last flight, everybody's always in a rush to get off and get to the... get information, inspection officer give him all the information. Everybody's always in a hurry to get off and get to the dining room and whatever, and then get to bed.
Well, I've got some more big picture questions for you, but one thing I read about you was that VE Day for you was pretty memorable. Do you remember where you were when you found out that Germany had surrendered? And the war was over?
We was in the movie theater. I think we were in the balcony, I'm not sure. I don't know what the movie was now. They shut it down, lit it up, and someone, probably the manager, walked onto the stage and said that they had received news that the war was over. So, and then the theater emptied, and the pub doors opened.
And, you know, I've talked to a lot of American veterans about what that meant. But I'm sure for someone who had seen firsthand the damage, the destruction that the British people endured for 6 years of war almost, what did that mean to you to know that that was finally over?
Oh, that was marvelous. You know, I mean, you imagine these people all crowding out the theater, to hell with the theater, you know. Pub doors opened and getting in the pubs and getting a few drinks, and then some of them would get too many drinks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that because I didn't go home that night. No, I didn't. I stayed at the brother and sister.
Okay.
I stayed at their house, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the following morning I needed a shave, you know, and her father lent me his razor, you know, cut throat.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I know. I really cut my face in several places.
And I guess I should ask you, too, since, you know, other than Pearl Harbor and the waters off the coast, the war really didn't come to the American homeland, right? But your homeland was bombarded for years. It just seems like the level of fear or anticipation that Brits had to live with during the war was different compared to Americans.
Yeah, I really didn't have much chance to mix or whatever with the civilians at all, but they seemed cheery enough, you know, unless they were in a real... In the north of England was different to what it was in the south of England, London area especially. They're the ones that got all the bombing. The north of England got some... But not like London. Liverpool got whacked, you know, a few times, and Manchester, which are on the west coast of England, they got some bombs. And then in the Midlands, they got it, you know, the Birmingham, because there was a lot of munitions building and that. And at Liverpool, because of the shipping. But at my hometown of Bradford, they said it got bombed twice, but not much. There was a movie theater that got bombed, but everybody had just left the theater. Then they hit the theater.
Wow.
But I think it was those kind of bombing things were usually caused by when the Germans came over for some target, dropped their stuff wherever they could. And I think that's why, I think our town, because there wasn't much in our town that would bother them. But between our town and the next one, there was an aircraft factory. And then there was another munitions place. And one of them was under the ground. But and of the other towns, just little bits here and there. But nothing like London.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. But also, maybe your perspective on this would be helpful for us to hear. Can you give us perspective on what it meant for Great Britain when America joined the war?
Well, I think it was a damn good thing, because eventually, if they hadn't, it would have affected America, especially financially, you know. It would have affected America. Well, America had to deal with all those countries in the Far East, you know, around there, which there were more countries, and, well, say all our countries, I guess all the different countries are connected together. You know, all the different countries in Europe were all connected together, and Germany had had every one of them controlled.
World could have been a lot different. Another question that came to mind, because it was Christmas Eve when you had that hairy mission, is that something you've thought about on the 80 Christmas Eves you've had since then?
Well, yeah, I always think some of it, because that particular time I was very friendly with a WAF. When we got hit and I got back, she was in the intelligence branch, you know, and she was always there to greet you when you got back, give you a shot of whiskey or some hot coffee or something like that to kind of tend you down.
That WAF that you were friendly with then, is that the one whose picture's on the wall here? Like a lot of retirement living facilities, the Brookdale here has a wall of honor with all the veterans' pictures. There's a lot of American veterans, but there's two Brits right in the middle, you and your wife. And it was the Royal Air Force that brought you together? What's the story there?
Oh, we met. Yes, the war was over, but I was still in the Air Force. And I was stationed at a place called Kirkham, which is an RAF station not far from the Blackpool. That's a seaside resort. When I first went there, I was just messing around, doing nothing, really. And then I became the assistant adjutant. And we went on that for a while. And then the adjutant, who was a big old guy, look at him, you'd think he'd been in there since a year, nod. He was only a flight lieutenant that was one rank above me. He was decided he was going to come out of the Air Force. He'd been in for years. He was in way before the war began. I said, well, don't recommend me for your job. I said, don't worry. You know. So anyway, he didn't recommend me. So that was. But where our camp was, Kirkham is on the east coast of Lancashire. At the time, it was a training unit. Four sections. There was a WAF section. I got to duty officer once or twice. That's where first thing in the morning you wake up and you say, rise and shine, wakey wakey, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And then I went up a rank, and then they had this camp. It was where the Americans had been brought in. I guess a lot of them had gone on the D-Day thing, probably from there. And they sent me there to be the officer in charge. I was there until I decided to come out. And my wife wanted to come out, but she couldn't come out until her time was up. So her time wasn't up. But if she'd have been married, she could have got out straight away. So that's what's happened. We decided to get married.
So she could get out sooner.
So she could get out sooner, yeah. She didn't have any parents. She had this older sister. The brother went into the service, so he was there no longer. So I guess my wife decided she'd join the WAFs. And so that's what she did. And she had been in 3 years.
And it seems like it worked out okay for both of you.
Yeah. The only thing is she passed away too soon. Well, she had a heart problem.
And so I've got to ask you, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for telling this story no one else could tell us. And thank you for helping to save the world 80 years ago. You're 103, almost 104. So when you look back over 103 years, what would you say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I was very thankful for my wife, naturally. She was a honey. She really was, yeah.
And there must be something that keeps you going. What's your secret to being in this good a shape physically and mentally at almost 104?
Just to keep going, because each day you get old age get weaker. I've always been one that's been going, you know. I don't know, I guess it's just determination just to keep going and whatever, you know. I just wish she'd have lasted a bit longer.
Ron Holdsworth, 103 years old. You can read more of his story in Arnold Martinez's book, Never Forget. And I mentioned that if you live close enough, you can welcome him home. He's one of the latest veterans to benefit from a program called Soaring Valor, the Gary Sinise Foundation, which is involved in so many wonderful programs, for years has been flying World War II veterans to the World War II Museum in New Orleans. So Ron gets to head there this week, and on Friday, August 29th at 6 o'clock at the Bakersfield Meadows Field Airport, his friends from Honor Flight Kern County, Brookdale Senior Living, and others will welcome him home. I'm not sure if I can make it yet, but I think I'm going to try. And if I make it, I'd love to see you there too. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that in America, in the UK, and really anywhere, freedom is not free.